This is a tough one. Slavery. You know, it's difficult to imagine, you know, if one hadn't, you know, had a chance to read the Torah, that the Torah would seemingly permit slavery. This is the most abusive form of relationship that exists. You know, where one person enslaves another person, and to, for one who isn't acquainted with this, to think that the Torah would permit such a thing, is almost unimaginable. And yet we find in this week's parsha two forms of seemingly we'll call it slavery, the Eved Kanani and the Eved Ivri. The Eved Kanani, the quote unquote non-Jewish slave, is found in Parshas Bahar. It's found in other places in the Torah. And you know, what is one to make of it? The Rav Soloveitchik used to say that if you want to understand the hashkafa of the Torah, you want to understand the philosophy of the Torah, you need to look at the halacha, you need to look at the details. Because often, if you go through the details of what is permitted and is not permitted, what you will find is something that looks nothing like what you thought previously. And I'd like to go through some of the halachas of slavery. And after seeing this, I believe you will have a very different perspective on what the Torah means by slavery, both for the, you know, the Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave, and the non-Jewish slave. And we'll discuss a little bit about, you know, what the Torah's concept of allowing slavery to exist is for. First of all, there is an idea found in the Torah, in the Gemara, of concepts which the Torah permits. We'll use the term grudgingly so. In the beginning of Parshas Ki Tzetzeh, the Torah goes through an idea that a Jewish soldier may go out to battle and find a beautiful woman and desire her and take her for a wife. And the Torah goes through a series of procedures that one has to do for that to be permitted. Now, that would seem that that's okay. No, that's not okay. The Gemara says very clearly that Lo Dibra Torah L'Kinegad Yetzer Hara, the Torah was saying this for a person's desires, meaning to say that the Torah did not want people to do it. Assuming that people were going to not control themselves, the Torah then gave a series of rules that one has to follow if they're going to do this. However, this does not make it something which is a good idea to do. In fact, it's a horrible idea. So if a person, according to the Medrash, were to do such a thing, force this woman to marry him, the result is the continuation of the Torah, which is a person will have two wives, one which he loves and one which he hates, and then he'll have a rebellious son. Any relationship which is started because a person covets a woman and forces her to marry him, the Torah is trying to prevent is rape. So the Torah says, you know, this is if you're going to not control yourself, better follow this procedure than you know, take it into your own hands. However, even following this procedure, it's certainly not a recommended idea. So the expression the Gemara uses is a dibratar ela kenegadi tzahara. The Torah is talking to a person's evil desires. Okay, now is slavery a similar concept? Now, two of the greatest rabbis of the, I'll quote them, previous generations, Rav Hirsch and Rav Moshe Feinstein, both talk about slavery in the most disparaging terms. I'll start with Rav Hirsch. He says the saddening experiences of our own times. He's talking about the struggle over slaves in the United States. He was a rabbi he was alive in the 1850s and 1860s. Show how wretched and vulnerable is the lot of a slave, no matter whether he is deprived of his rights by accepted international law, was granted equal rights, but is still universally looked upon as a slave or someone who was a slave, which was and to an extent is the case in the United States. And the fact that, you know, people who were formerly enslaved, although they're not legally enslaved anymore, are still dealing with that perception and that the societal bias against them. And this is a terrible thing. Ramosha Feinstein, in describing the name of God of Shakai, which God says enough, says this is, he says, when God will look at humanity acting in a horrible fashion and then say enough. The two examples of this that he quotes are the Jews in Egypt. God said, Shakai, enough. I'm going to take the Jews out. And Ramosha says, this is why God suddenly said that slavery has to be done. This is a disgusting, horrible thing. for whatever reason, God allowed humanity to sin in regards to people enslaving other people. At a certain point, God said enough, for Moshe Feinstein writes, and this is similar to the Jews leaving Egypt when he says that the society turned against this at the will of God and said, this is not going to be acceptable anymore. Okay, that being the case, what are the conditions in halacha of slavery? So we're talking about it on a philosophical level, that slavery is a terrible idea, yet we know the Torah seems to permit some form of slavery. What is that slavery that the Torah is discussing? So I'll go through some of the basic rules of a slave, of an Eved Kanani, of a quote-unquote non-Jewish slave, although as we'll see in a second, it's not really a non-Jew. And what we'll end up with is something which resembles nothing like what we've seen in recent centuries in what was slavery. And number one, and I think this is the most important halacha to be clear of, is for there to be an effective society that controls slaves, the only way to make a slave is to physically abuse it, right? If you can't physically control him, then he's not going to be a slave unless you're very nice to him. Now, it is forbidden to hit another person, even a quote-unquote slave. The Beis Yosef, which is written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, it is forbidden to raise one's hand against or physically hurt in any way any person, including an Eved Kanani. The Bach, the Beis Chadash, which is the Shulchan Aruch's partner in their commentaries on the Torah, writes that the punishment for hitting a slave, for whatever technical reasons, is going to be more severe than if a Jew were to hit another Jew. Okay, now, try running a society, a slave society, in which you're not allowed to hurt the slaves in any way. Not going to be a way in which the slaves are going to do anything. Clearly, we're not talking about regular slavery. Number two, the Gemara neither writes clearly that it is forbidden to embarrass any person or shame them or do anything demeaning to them. And the Gemara says that this applies to slaves. You are not allowed to embarrass or shame them in any way. The Gemara quotes an incident where Shmuel was one of the rabbis in the Gemara, apparently by accident, embarrassed a slave and paid the full compensation that one is required to pay to somebody else if they embarrass them. So you're not allowed to physically hurt them. You're not allowed to embarrass them. What then is this slavery? Clearly, it is nothing like anything that was going on in the Confederate States. So what would this slavery look like? Now, I'll quote to you what the Rambam writes in the Laws of Slavery. Now, I'm just translating this as slavery, even though I think if, you know, once you see what the laws entail, you're going to have to find a more appropriate term for whatever this concept is. Even if a person is going to do it, these are the rules which one has to follow. So I will translate the Rambam for you. The Rambam writes, it is the way of a person who is intelligent and has any decency to him, that he will be merciful and be just and will not force his call it a slave or a servant, to work hard. He will not harm him in any way in regards to food and drink. He will give him everything that he eats to drink. The Rambam writes that a Jewish person who had a servant would give him everything that he ate. He would make sure he ate before he ate, meaning he would make sure that his servant had what to eat before he was eating himself. The Rambam writes he would not ever scream at him or get upset at him. He would listen to all of his complaints. He would not treat him in any cruel fashion. And it is incumbent upon every Jew, if he's going to have a servant, to act with the decency of the Torah. I'm translating the Rambam for you once again. And he will be merciful fully to him, and he will act just as God acts to all of humanity. He will treat any servant that is in his household. So when you combine all of this, whatever the Eved Kanani is certainly nothing like a regular slave. If you want to call it a worker, you want to call it somebody who is in your house, who is under a household worker, that would probably be a better term than actually calling him a slave. The Kesef Mishnah, which is one of the prime commentaries on the Rambam, quote several interesting Gemaras. He quotes a Gemara in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in the Babylonian Talmud, which says that Rabbi Yochanan would make sure that his household workers or his servants, if he was eating meat, they had meat. If he drank wine, they drank wine. And he would make sure that they were not eating anything less than him. They were eating everything that was served at his table. The Gemara Maseches Ksubos writes that there was two scholars. One of them would let the household work eat for, you know, enjoy everything they were eating. They would eat together. And the other one would only give them some of the food. And because the second one wasn't as nice as the first one, so he did not merit that Elijah the prophet would reveal himself to him. Meaning he was not able to reach spiritual levels because he did not treat his household help as his equal. The Gemara recalls another incident in which a person would not make sure that his household help had what to eat before he ate, and he would eat first and then serve them afterwards. And as a result, also, he was not able to achieve these spiritual levels because he did not treat his servants as being entitled to whatever he was taking. And this reaches the point that the Aruch HaShulchan, which is a very important halachic source, writes. The Gemara says that if a person were to say that I'm not going to feed my servants, the courts won't get involved. And the Aruch HaShulchan, which is written by Rabbi Michael Epstein, explains that the reason for this is because what would happen is the servant would run away if he's not being fed. And if he's not being fed, the courts will facilitate him to run away because his master is mistreating him. So essentially, what they're going to do is if there's a master who is mistreating his servant, they'll facilitate him to escape, which he says would be kedin Torah, that'd be justified under the principles of the Torah, that if a person is not treating a servant right, that he should escape. So what you're looking at is, and I didn't live in those times, and I don't know how common this was that people had people under what we would call servants or slaves, but the life they would have to be treated with, based on all these very very mainstream sources, would be a very non-abusive life. Okay, that being the case, nonetheless, did these people ask to be put in the position they're in? Right, very well, you have to treat them nicely, but are you just picking people off the street and forcing them into this, we'll call it benevolent slavery, but it's a slavery nonetheless? And the answer to that is that under no circumstances is a Jew allowed to force another person into slavery. You can't go on an expedition and capture people and enslave them. That is completely forbidden. Where would one get these slaves from? So this is the circumstances under which a person could acquire a slave. A person could willingly become a slave. If a Jew were to purchase a slave from a non-Jew, the Gemara in Yevamos writes that he has to offer him the right to convert. And this is a conversion process offered to an Eved Kanani. They're called a non-Jewish slave, but they're not really non-Jewish because they're given this opportunity to convert. And if they're not allowed to be forced into this conversion, it has to be offered to them. And if they do not want to accept this, then you have to let them go. You have 12 months to try to convince them to become Jewish and enter this lifestyle. And if they're not interested, you have to let them go. If a person were to hold a slave without giving him this opportunity to convert, the law is that if you're holding a worker under circumstances in which he is not being offered this opportunity to convert, and if he's not interested, you let him go, then that Jewish person is not allowed to offer the Korban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice. The Pesach sacrifice is the sacrifice which symbolizes freedom. And if you're holding a servant without giving him this opportunity to be Malva Taval, to undergo circumcision and the tefillah, the immersion of a convert, in which he is Granted, we'll explain in a second what that state is, but it is a conversion. And then he's granted this right. Then you're not allowed to bring the Pesach sacrifice because you have in your household a member who is basically not being treated the way he should be. So the symbolism of our freedom is denied to that person. Now, the two most stringent positive commandments in the Torah are milah, circumcision, and carbon Pesach, and the Pesach sacrifice. Those are the only two positive commandments which, if one fails to fulfill them, one is liable for kares, for spiritual, being cut off spiritually, and early death, whatever that entails. So if a person were to hold a slave in this limbo, then he's denied the right to bring a carbon Pesach, because how can you bring the carbon which celebrates our freedom if you yourself are denying that to another person? Now, I'll just add in this conversion that the slave willingly undergoes, if he chooses to do so, gives him an obligation to perform mitzvos like a Jew. It does not require him to marry a Jew, though. So it's an interesting, in that sense, it's not a full slavery, in that he's not forced into, you know, this is a person who culturally one would assume may be converting into this form of conversion because, let's say, he financially needs to do this, or he wants to partake in this hopefully benevolent society that he's going to join. But that being the case, he may not be fully acclimated to Jewish society, and he therefore can marry. This I'm assuming the reason, but the law is, and he can still marry a non-Jew. So in that sense, it's not conversion. And based on this, when his master were to set him free, he undergoes a conversion to being a full Jew, to the point that the Gemara suggests that there may often be the case that a this servant would not want freedom because he would then be required to marry a Jew. And that may be something he's not interested in. That would, you know, obviously depend on the person. But this gives you the idea of just what the halacha demands of those are going to go through this process. And that being the case, I'm not so sure that those that actually participated in this were in any way encouraged by the Torah. So obviously, if a person would go over to a Jew and say willingly, which would seem to have been the typical case, I would like to go through this process. I would like to go to the conversion and become a member of your household and be entitled to this basic treatment that you're required to treat the servants. That would presumably be okay. But if there's any coercion involved, which is halakhically forbidden, and in many cases would invalidate the process, that would certainly, one could say, would fall under the category of la dibra Torah ela kenegad yetzer hara, that one is taking what the Torah is allowing completely out of context, and is being unfortunately affected by his surroundings. If he lives in a society in which slavery is being permitted, I'll end off this piece with a thought from Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler was a very impactful philosopher, called that religious philosopher. I passed away about 50 years ago. The name of his book is a series of books is called Mechtev Eliyahu. Some of it has been translated into English. It's called Strive for Truth, I think. In any case, he writes that the concept of slavery, in which the Torah permits, is only to be taken as people working within the context of a household. So you have a company, and you have workers. Workers do different things. If a person is going to view, we'll call it a slave once again, but there's probably should be a better word for it, that he wants to join us, he wants to join a household and work for them, that would be the context in which the Torah would permit slavery. He says what slavery was perverted into is strong people controlling weak people, not, once again, some people joining up other people because they feel this is a productive means for their life. And he says a very, very scathing remark that the reason why you found, and maybe to some extent still find, a certain, what he calls, quote unquote, pretend dignity in certain societies, and I think he's referring to the antebellum South, in which, you know, you had people acting very genteel fashion, acting very cultured and well-mannered, is what those people are trying to do is convince themselves that they are a superior level or caste of humanity, and they prove it by acting with this quote-unquote dignified manner, and they convince themselves that that gives them the right to subjugate other people because they have this, they view themselves as being superior because of the way they act. And he says this is a total corruption of anything the Torah ever permitted. All the Torah was allowing conceptually, and as we quoted from many sources in the halakha practically, was having people join up into a society and participating to the extent that they want that they would be able to contribute to a society. To a similar extent, although it takes on a different form, because in this case it is forced on them, is the Jewish slave. So a Jewish slave, which has a lot of similar rules, in which the Jewish slave is to be treated with great dignity, and he has to be offered the same food and drink that the owner, quote unquote, the owner has. So that can be taken upon a person willingly. If a person is poor and would like to join up the household of another person. With a Jewish slave, it can be forced upon a person. And the instance for that is that if a Jew steals and cannot pay back, then the courts will force him into, and it's only a temporary state, it's a maximum of 6 years, into working for another household. And the idea behind this is that there is no concept in the Torah of jail. The penitentiary system doesn't exist for stealing. And I think if anybody's even remotely familiar with the American penal system, there are a lot of very awful side effects from anybody who has to enter jail. People suffer tremendously in jail. People's lives get very corrupted in jail. They're under all sorts of bad influences just to have to survive in jail. Jail is not a good place for criminals to go. Now, society has deemed, whether they're right or wrong, that this is something we need to do as a deterrent. In the Torah's view, if a person steals and can't pay back, the restitution he has to make is the courts will hire him out as one of these, called an indentured servant, with a maximum of 6 years. His family is taken care of. He's taken care of. All his needs are taken care of. The master has to treat him with dignity. But while he's there, he pays restitution, and his dignity must be preserved. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes note that the reason why Parshas Mishpatim starts with Eved Ivri is because we must view the Eved Ivri as a person who is how we approach Mishpatim. Mishpatim is law and order, and the law and order that we have needs to take into account that people are not going to abide by law and order. And as a result, we need to have some form of them making compensation for what they do. The master, or master is once again a bad term, the person who takes upon himself this indentured servant, if you will, is required very strictly by law to treat him with dignity and not look at him or treat him in a demeaning way. And he should view this, hopefully, now more comfortable lifestyle that this former thief is leading as a way to rehabilitate him by living in this wealthy person's house, or this person who is better to do than he is, and being treated as an equal, and hopefully finding use of his talent. And the halacha is that he's not allowed to be forced to work in anything that's demeaning. He has to work in the skills that he possesses. And once again, his master, the Gemara says, if his master only has one pillow, he has to give it to him. He has to treat him as comfortably as he is. And if the master only has one pillow or one steak or one bottle of wine, then the master can't drink it because he's not treating that person as an equal. And by going through this process, we can actually hope that he'll get rehabilitated. So the one instance in quote-unquote Jewish slavery in which a person was forced into it is basically a replacement for the penal system. And as an interesting note, there's a halakhic ruling for Moshe Feinstein. He writes that there was a person who was found to have stolen some valuable items from a shul. And there was a question if they could report him to the police, which would have ended in him going to jail. And Rav Moshe Feinstein said that if that person, if he can be assumed he's going to do it again, you have to stop it. That's the only way to do it. But as a form of retribution, you're not allowed to send a person to jail. He says the Torah never authorizes jail. If a person steals, we have a much more gentle way of forcing him to make right what he's done wrong, which is Eved Ivri. The jail system in the United States looks nothing like what an Eved Ivri should have to go through. And therefore, as a form of retribution, you should not send him to jail. Now, if he can pay for it, you obviously can get the money out of him. And if your goal is to get him to pay compensation for what he's done, that certainly is permitted. But to have somebody end up in jail if they don't pose any threat for the future is something which he says is wrong to do, because that he calls physical torture. Doesn't use those exact words, but that's what he seems to be referring to. And the Torah looks down upon even a thief having to go through that. All right, I hope I didn't quote too many sources, too much information. Just trying to give you a little bit of a whirlwind, the background of this, pretty misunderstood subject or difficult subject to crack. If you think I'm overloading with you, this is a subject found in many places in the Gemara. It's a very complicated and broad subject. Hopefully I was able to provide you with some basic information. Feel free to pop up with questions or comments or discussion points.
Rabbi, thank you. And thanks for bringing up circumcision, because it really, you know, leads back to Lech Lecha. And I was just reading that over again, where, you know, God is introducing circumcision, right? And I think that mostly I would think before your conversation tonight that you think of circumcision from offspring, from Jewish, you know, parents, the father to a son. But the Torah goes out of its way to say that Abraham was also commanded to circumcise both the slaves of his household and the slaves bought outside, which makes it seem like those are Jewish slaves and non-Jewish slaves that are being circumcised. So it's a very tough subject, of course. I mean, the whole concept of slavery, but this level of respect and dignity that, you know, that's given to, I mean, the covenantal right is through circumcision, and that is given to slaves is fascinating. And, you know, in terms of, well, why did the Torah go out of its way to point, and of course, there's other parts of the Torah. I didn't look it up right now, but if I remember Yom Kippur, right? I mean, everybody is supposed to, no one can work that day. I think it goes out of its way too to explain, and including your slaves.
Right. So the slaves are required to observe the Torah. If they undergo this process, it's a basic conversion. You know, as I mentioned, they're not required to marry Jews, which, you know, most people would think is a fundamental part of being a convert. But they're offered this it is considered a conversion, even if it's missing that part of conversion, and this is not offered to them against their will. They're free to accept it, and then once again, if they don't want it, you're supposed to let them go. So you're inviting them into your household, hopefully, and properly following the halacha, you know, willingly. And that's the I can't tell you, because this hasn't been in practice, obviously, for a very long time. Even, you know, you look at halachic authorities from 500-600 years ago, they're like, we've never seen this in practice, but this is the tradition. But hopefully this was actually kept that way. And hopefully the communities, if this was something which was practiced, was, you know, this was done without coercion. But
I mean, I think that this just makes the point that I think what we think of as slavery is actually, you know, very modern and maybe, you know, more specific to more European society, and you know, using the word slavery in the context of the Torah is not really the same thing at all. It's more like an indentured servant, I guess, someone who has rights, and it's not for their whole life. It doesn't get transmitted to their children. It's nothing at all like what we think of as slavery. And then I had a question, and maybe you answered this. I've been slightly distracted. but what would motivate the non-Jewish servant to go through that initial conversion process rather than just, you know, have to, you know, be let go after 12 months?
I'm not sure. This might be an economic decision on their part, you know, that they would hopefully be granted a care. There may have been people who were, you know, I'll quote a Gemara. There's a Gemara which says something a little cryptic, something along the lines of that slavery unfortunately exists in the world. Like the hope of some of these people was to get proper treatment by a Jewish person. And possibly they would. I don't know if this is the case, but maybe they would hope that they could better their lot by asking to be sold to a Jew and then going through this process. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I think it was common, you know, in colonial times for people to you know, kind of hire themselves out mm-hmm. into a household. Hopefully there was, you know, this was with rights and join another household. And you know, if they were a good family, be treated as a member of the family. You know, we don't, you know, we're not, because we have vacuum cleaners and modern conveniences and all these kind of things. You know, household help is not something which is as common as it was 100 years ago. You know, it was very common from reading historical accounts of having, you know, people who lived in other people's houses and worked there. So mm-hmm. if this was the norm, possibly people would be willing to go through this. I'm not sure. Rav Hirsch seems to indicate that to an extent, this might have just been the Torah trying to work within the context of what was considered what would have happened anyway, and do it the best it could for those that were going to, you know, if you're going to force people into this, let's throw down a whole bunch of rights and hopefully guarantee them that they're treated as best as possible. No, I don't know if you went to your rabbi and he would suggest in any way you should do this to somebody, but if this was going to happen, this is the circumstances, being as these are the circumstances that you have to follow, you're going to end up with something which at least will treat him as a human being. Yes, Moshe Chaim.
I want to speak very honestly. You really impressed me tonight, because you choose, when I saw the title of the Dvar Torah, I said, okay, he's Meshuga. He's working on a mining field, and the subject was treated thoroughly. I think that you must be you have been sweating bullets sometime.
As I sometimes tell people, I didn't write this. I'm just trying to do the best I can to understand it.
For this, it's really commendable. It's not easy. It's easy in the Torah. I will say that it's even better the Torah, because in Sefer Devarim, we have a parallel passage where suddenly the Eved Knani disappear, is only the Eved Ivri, and the master needs to send it back with a pension plan forever, and big rejoicing. But in Mishpatim is a little bit more rough. The Jewish master can breed slaves. If he gives him a non-Jewish woman, so it's quite hard, and the Torah is phase, and this is the only passage in the whole Torah. It never appear whereas where Mishpatim is put a social evil, because it is there. How can you dare make a man of a woman of a slave when you have been freed? in Eretz Mitzrayim. And in the Gemara, this is this conflict to try to improve the situation of the slave. It's not a misharet, is not a servant. He's really, and if you hit him and he survived 2 days, it's not a problem. It's your money. It's, so what can we do with this? So when you say that he's need, I would love to be invited for 3 months to convert, not to be pushed away. Can you imagine?
Now, Moshe Chaim, you're breaking up a little. I'll just mention a couple more details. The Gemara says clearly in regards to the quote-unquote breeding that you're not allowed to take a Kanani woman and force her into a relationship that is embarrassing to her or something she doesn't want. The focus of what we'll call that quote-unquote forcing them to take a wife is on the Eved Ivri, that the Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave, can be told to marry a Kanani woman. The Gemara says clearly that the Kanani woman cannot be forced to do something against her will. Part of the concept of not being allowed to embarrass them is that you can't force them into a relationship that they don't want. What so that the, idea of
Rabbi Meir, the Gemara comes quite later than the Torah is a commentary on a commentary on the Mishnah. So because this social evil is very difficult to solve. I can tell you that at the 18th century in the Antilles, Jews, more Sephardic Jews and also Ashkenazim owned slaves, and they could enter the shul, but by a different door. They were buried in a different spot in the Jewish cemetery, and the concern was not concern was mainly a concern of kashrut. He was still a slave, but not really a Jew. And there, so you are not, he was an Unterjuden. You understand now the concept of Unterjuden? He was a Jew, but not too much, just enough of, to take
this is in the 16th century, you said?
Yes, it's 18th century.
It's 18th not century.
Old. Yes, and the situation of Philippine.
Where was this? Where did this take place? I was looking for records of this in recent, at least in halakhic literature.
I can send you the reference. It's I can send you the reference. So I will make a PDF, and I can send the PDF to everybody. And the situation of Filipino workers today in Eretz Israel, of women doing work in kibbutzim for a salary that is you cannot even buy a toothpick, is shameful. Is a slavery that does not bear his name. So the Torah places the one front. What are you going to do? Okay, you want to have slave. How are you going to treat them? Why are it possible? I freed you from slavery, and you impose a slavery on another human being. How can you desecrate my name like this? So when I said he is crazy, he's going to be shot. Honestly, I thought it is such a difficult subject, and he has so much connection with what we live here in America, where we have a country that it was built by black slave, by Chinese slave. We were as a Jew treated like a garbage when we came, and. How is possible? This is the covenant at Sinai, and we discuss. So maybe it's an end to your server. happened. It was not so bad. We were not so bad. We did not tweet. And the Gemara said, you do this and you do this and you do that. So my blood is boiling.
Moshe Chaim, I'm not justifying anything. I'm not saying that anybody should take slaves. It is very difficult.
The Torah doesn't say that you should take one.
If you're going to do something which may be morally unjustifiable and terrible, you may be required to at least follow something that at least we can preserve some sort of dignity to these people. Meaning to say, you know, similarly to that concept of that I started with of Eishes Yevas Torah, which the Torah says, don't do this. If you're going to do this, you're going to have to at least follow some rules that we can try to maintain something for these people. Meaning, don't do it. It's a bad thing to do. However, if you're going to live in a society where you're going to do it anyway, you're required to at least do something. We'll force you to follow some sort of basic rules that we can control it a little bit. You know, if you were to walk in 1840s into Alabama and tell people, oh, by the way, this is terrible, they'd stone you. You might have to work with them slowly. So this doesn't mean to your eyes that this is something that should be done in that context. This may be telling people who live in a society which this is done already, listen, we're not going to be able to stop you from doing this completely, but perhaps, you know, you'll follow at least these rules and from there you'll learn to treat them with some respect. I don't know. This is, as you said, a very difficult subject.
Right. Well, and since when are Jews always perfect in their, you know, following the commandments, you know, otherwise maybe, you know, Mashiach would have already come. I mean, this is nothing new, you know.
Yeah.
Well, people can pick and choose and justify all sorts of things, you know.
It cannot be justified. And the Torah.
Moshe Chaim, I didn't mean to try to justify.
We're agreeing with you, I think.
Yeah,
we all agree.
Is the particular, the text is very subtle. You will put them in front of their face. It's like you put your nose on it, on your own evil. How can you dare? That is the only, so I search, even in a computer concordance, this pasuk was forgotten. Mm-hmm. Is not there. You can search, believe me. You can search, it is not there. So, but it's the Torah. during the speech, sometime the sun was cut off or frozen. So I hope to listen again tomorrow so to understand the part that was not there.
Yeah. I'll end off if we will. There's a Gemara Maseches Kedushin which writes that if a person is going to sin, he should put on, I think this is a known Gemara, he should put on black clothing, you know, kind of go to another town, and then hopefully, you know, by not having everybody see what he did, he won't get so sucked into his sinful ways that he'll be able to recover you know, the next day.
Oh, Rabbi, what are you doing here?
Whoa. I wear a white shirt, you know, just a jacket dark. And then this is a blue one, so.
Moshe Chaim, you there. But you told me that this is poor.
You know, you're right. You know, some things have to be understood in the context of dealing with the reality, and some things are the proper way things should be. And I would have a hard time listening to anybody suggest that this is something that should be, you know. If you're going to say that, you know, there may have been people who did it properly, okay, that could be. But on a societal level, you know, you're absolutely right to assume that you have a society which one group of people is in any way controlling another group of people, you know, to do things for them. That's an unjust society. That I think is hopefully understood by everybody. And if it's not, then okay, what can I do? Haters are gonna hate. But you know, within the context of the reality that has been history over many, you know, in many different eras, You know, I think given the conditions, you know, which the Torah lets, you know, sets out, is going to vastly improve the situation of anybody that has to, you know, live under such circumstances.
So, Rabbi.
Yeah. Okay.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Yes, of course.
Shabbat shalom. See you, Rabbi.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, be well.